Well, thank you, Tom. With that kind of introduction, I'm sure I can disappoint as many people as you want. The interesting thing is they gave me the award yesterday before I spoke. After I'm done, they'll take the award back. That's kind of how that works. But I really am pleased to see so many of you from so many different areas. And welcome to California and all the work that Allison and the crew have done on this program, phenomenal, and thanks to that group again. I would say that in terms of the gold rush, my family actually left Ireland and came to California in 1850, crossed the plains, settled in a little town called Oroville, which means gold in Spanish, for those of you who realize, and we never left. We're still there since 1850. They brought the family Bible across the plains. Every birth and death and marriage is recorded. So I have a little more history with the gold rush than some of you. In fact, most of us just stayed in Oroville, married our cousins because there was nobody else. And I'm a living example of inbreeding depression wherever Donald Brown is. The good thing about it is we exposed a lot of genetic defects along the way. I call those my cousins. They call me the genetic defects. It works both ways. But we're pretty closely tied to the land and to cattle. And I guess I'll speak to you today, obviously not as an academic, because I think of myself as a commercial producer first and foremost. And be very frank with you, I think of myself as a family commercial producer. And that's not necessarily what we've heard yet. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong, but I want to share a slightly different perspective. I think you're going to get to hear from Chip in a few minutes, and I know he'll do a phenomenal job in addressing the large cow-calf producers, but I want to think about this as a little smaller. With reference to the gold rush, though, just so you know how tough this business is, see if this will work. Just so you know how tough this business is, my son's birthday, Rob, the little guy, the youngest, I won't call him the little guy or I'll be in trouble. We walked out the morning of his birthday, and my dad and mom, who were there before the crack of dawn, even though they live an hour away, in their 80s, had delivered his present, a gold pan and a sluice box. And on the side of the sluice box, my mom, his grandma, had stenciled Daily Ranch Stimulus Plan. We laugh, but survival isn't easy. And I believe you talked about your grandmother in the Depression, Dr. Lawrence. My dad grew up through that time, and he talks about going out in the creeks when it got a little tough, his dad going out in the creeks and finding enough gold for beans and flour and the deer that they poached. And that's the tough times that they survived through. And he thinks we could be there again. He said, so the sluice box may be a joke. He's given us one lesson so far. I don't know where we're going to go from here. By the way, with regard to that inbreeding depression joke, the good thing about it is that I went to Colorado State and learned I took animal breeding classes before there were any planned matings, and I was smart enough to find somebody from completely outside of the area who believed in outcrossing and was willing to come to California. Illinois corn, soybean, cattle person. So we got enough of an outcross that our kids are way better off than us. It really helps, and they're living proof of it. That you can make genetic improvement is pretty simple. You just got to find the right outcross. In terms of introduction, though, I think we have a real basic question. And this is fundamentally different for all of us. Are we ranching with money, or are we ranching for money? And all of us have to ask ourselves that question. And if you know people in the top line, more power to them. I am simply jealous. But I will tell you, if you're ranching for money, it may change the answers to some of the questions. Secondarily, and many of you probably also know this, if you agree with what I'm saying, a sample size of one is sufficient. Right? You already agree with me, so you can go have coffee. If you don't agree with what I'm saying, a study with 10,000 head won't change your mind. So you can go have coffee too. I told Cindy I was going to say that. She goes, you aren't going to have anybody listening to you. They're either going to agree or disagree. They're all going to be out in the hallway. And there might be some truth to that. But you know how we are when we hear something we don't agree with? What do we spend most of our time doing? Not listening, just thinking how we're going to respond to prove the other person wrong. That's just our natural tendency. So with that said, let's keep as open-minded as you can. My favorite cattleman, Albert Einstein, said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And guess what? I'm still here talking about crossbreeding, so who the hell's insane? Might be me. We can go through these pretty quickly. Genetic improvement, all of you know we have two choices. Most of the time yesterday we focused on selection with inbreed use of genetic predictors. We're talking about refining those marker breeding values or breeding EPDs, But we didn't talk very much about the second one. And we can do that pretty briefly. And as I said, if you agree with me, it's a pretty short talk. We already know this. I'm going to click through these real rapidly. How do we put those breeds together to make a logical complement? This one okay with you? Everybody knows what heterosis is. The superiority of the crossbred progeny compared to the average of the parental breed. We know the difference between direct and maternal heterosis. The value of the crossbred cow. And I think a lot of commercial cattlemen get that. The market may suggest they need to go in different directions. But they understand the value of the crossbred cow. I really believe very strongly, and I may say it again at the end, that academics and purebred breeders need to listen to commercial producers. If they're still in business, they're doing something right. They have a lot to offer. They don't always need to be lectured to. They could be listened to. See what they need, listen to what they have to offer, and see why they're still surviving. We know this. Where are we going to get some advantages if we crossbreed? The lowly heritable traits, the non-additive genetic portion, the stuff that's a little difficult to see. You know, it's hard to say, boy, I had a little less embryonic death this year. Who knows? Right? Boy, there are a few more calves with a little more vigor. Who knows? But we know there's a large net positive cumulative effect. And folks, I am not telling you anything you shouldn't already know. I saw Dr. Cundiff wandering around this morning, who's far more versed and has done the work than I have in this regard. But this stuff was done in the 60s at first. The Fort Robinson work, Gregory and Cook and Cundiff at Clay Center. There's so much good information out there that we've chosen not to utilize for whatever reason, good or bad. We talked about heterosis of the calf, and these numbers, you can argue with them, you can find one slightly different in the literature. But if we talk about direct heterosis, we're really talking about the heterosis of the calf, the cross, that first cross. And I've got a little data to talk about that in a moment. But what I'm really interested in, frankly, is the maternal heterosis of the crossbred cow. And we need to think about, are we willing to give up 14.5% heterosis? Real quickly, and again, you can look at different numbers in the literature if you choose. Little things. Survival to weaning, 1.9%. Weaning weight, 3.9%. Calving rate, 4.4%. A little bit about our operation. And this has nothing to do with trying to... I just want to provide a context for you. I grew up in the commercial business, but the ranches that Cindy and I either own or lease are ranches that we've bought or that we lease. The debt load's ours. The financial constraints are real. And very frankly, the closer I become to becoming a full-time commercial producer, which I dearly love, the more skeptical I am of someone trying to tell me how I can make more money by buying a product from them. It's a direct, linear relationship. Okay? The more financial exposure and debt I have, the more I go, oh boy, you know, who's that going to make more money for? You sure it's me? I really have to ask that question. It will probably make money for somebody. Just not guaranteed I'm the one who's going to get the benefit. So if you sense a degree of skepticism among commercial producers, please do not attribute that to the fact that you think, well, they just aren't very smart. They might be real damn smart. They just want to make sure that there's some dollars returned to their pocket, not somebody else's pocket, before they make the choice. When you sign the checks that pay the bills, your life changes, right, Mike Smith? Absolutely. He said, yes, sir, I'm not that important. You know, the joke about this mustache, by the way, as long as we're telling jokes, and Tom, I will stay on time, I swear. As my hair fell out, I moved it down to my face. It was just simpler. It catches a lot of things, food and a variety of other things that we won't talk about, insects occasionally, all kinds of things. But I saw this guy in Canada when we did the last composite meeting up there in Calgary years ago. He was cool. He was bald like me and had a cool mustache. Not quite as cool as mine is now, but it was cool. Okay, right? And I thought, I'm going to do that. I'll shave my beard and grow this. Which I like it. It's kind of like detracting from the glare. It does some value for us. Well, the funny thing is I started thumbing through the old pictures from the first ones they could take, the 1800s that they didn't show, the early 1900s. And there's these bald guys with big mustaches who look just like me. It's kind of frightening. It's kind of frightening. I think they were all minors, and somebody in Canada knew that, and I ended up being a minor. Okay, but let's go to the next one. And I bolded the bottom ones. Longevity, 38%. Number of calves, 17%. Lifetime productivity. Cumulative weaning weight, 25% for having a crossbred cow. I believe we saw a slide in the last... Somebody had a speaker, a slide regarding how long you need to keep that cow to break even. Years 5, years 6, to break even. You want me to replace a heifer? Hey, if she can get bred and raise it, that's more than me replacing it with the female. That's costly. I can afford to lay a third of the longevity back on the table by not running a crossbred female. Sorry, not going to do it as a commercial producer. I will not do it. I cannot afford to do it. It makes no economic sense whatsoever to give up longevity. Probably the profit driver for most operations is longevity. So keep that in mind when you say, well, we can run them straight bred. I'm not going to. A little more about the operation. We don't hire any labor. And Cindy and I have full-time jobs. She works 22 hours a day at the university and 2 hours a day at home, I think. And I sleep most of the time. But we get a lot done with two of us and three kids and no hired labor. And this year we'll probably breed 1,000 cows. And wherever Dave Nichols is, right there, the cows better work for us because I don't have time. And you know that death rate thing, 1.9% to weaning? Hey, they're going to live or die in my deal. And you say, well, that's not very good management. It's cost effective. Sure took care of some problems for me. I had a friend from Texas up the other day who was looking at some bulls and looking at cows, and we found a dead one. And he's got a lot more cows than I do, by the way. I said, well, there's a dead one. He goes, you know, my workers call me occasionally. He's big enough. He has hired help. He says, we found a dead one. He goes, then why'd you call me? You know, what's the point? You know, what's the point at that point? It's already too late. Who cares at that point? That is part of the cost of doing business, if they're going to take care of me. You say, well, you could do a better job. I probably could do a better job. I just don't know if I'd make more money doing a better job. The perception of crossbreeding, and then I will get going here, increased variability, lack of consistency, mongrelize the nation's cow herd, too many breeds, lack of predictability. You can make a longer list. I don't like them. They're multicolored. You know, whatever the reason may be, go for it. Really part of the problem has been lifetime membership in the Breed of the Month Club, where we can't really decide what we want to do. Dr. Talbot, was this yours? Where's Tom? Oh, he knew I'd get him. That makes up for what you said to me the other day. Dr. Tom Talbot, president of CCA, that's his herd, sire. See if he asked me again to speak. There you go. All right, we know why crossbreeding has failed sometimes. We didn't do it right in places. And by the way, with these comments, there are some people doing it exceptionally well. And so I'm not suggesting the industry can't effectively use genetic diversity. I'm suggesting that we haven't done it widely enough to capitalize on some of our losses. Early failures because of the wrong genetic inputs. Oh, purebred breeders, how could I say such a thing? The culture. And frankly, the most important, the one with the exclamation point, is we don't measure the right stuff. We measure outputs. Always. And we can look at that. Let's compare that to what I would call as a planned crossbreeding system. Systematic, utilizing a resource base, retaining heterosis, complementing the breeds, simple, Dr. Field, marketable, matching cows to their environment, and measuring profit. The real reason we're doing it is because we're ranching for money. Those of you who saw me talk in Mississippi, I kicked out most of these slides, but I had to throw in two or three. And here's one. And all 10 of them are in the paper I submitted because I wasn't creative enough to write another paper. So I cut and pasted from the Mississippi proceedings. And the same 10 reasons I think apply. So if you want to look at the other 10, I'll only show you three or four today. Everybody knows a purebred's better. Right? Got to have papers on that gelding. May make a difference. Right? That's important. That's just the way we're hardwired that way. It's part of our culture. It's hard to accept anything else. So why not crossbreeding? We've decided measuring outputs is more meaningful than measuring inputs, and it's easier. We give awards for it. Average daily gain, ribeye area, quality gain, weaning weight, milk, the list goes on. We've done that for years. It's part of what we do. And if you're real lucky, you get something to hang on your wall for it. But it doesn't always have a whole hell of a lot to do with profit. Heterosis is difficult, so I'm skipping. You're going to see three or four of these. Heterosis is difficult to visualize, even more difficult to measure. We mentioned that. Longevity, morbidity, livability, age of puberty, and lifetime productivity. Wow. Those are what really drive our profit at the commercial level. That is how we stay in business. Live calves. Herb Holzapfel, I think, went home. But he told me afterwards, he goes, is Herb here? I don't want to speak for him because he's bigger than me. But he said they can say whatever they want, do whatever they want the next 2 days, but if I don't have a live calf and one that I don't have to put a lot of inputs to, the rest is a waste of my time. Don't ever lose sight of that. And this one is personal because I'm both. Our industry and academics have focused on individual animal measurements for over 50 years, including me. Including me. So I am making fun of myself here in this case, but it's what we do. We weigh them. We measure them. We poke and prod. We look at product. I looked at the paper I wrote last time. I thought, that's pretty good. I wonder who I stole it from. But this is what I said. By the way, have you ever done that, Tom? You've got an idea from somebody, and you've said it so many times, all of a sudden you think it's your own? It really makes you feel smart. I probably got all of these from somebody else. We've done a very poor job of incorporating real-world economics into our models. We have EPDs for a plethora of traits, and we're adding more. And now with markers, by the way. Economic indices are starting to catch up, but we're still behind. Has anyone thought about measuring return per acre or return on investment? We have had a disconnect between agricultural economics and animal science, right? Do they even have you guys in the same building at Iowa State? Oh, no, you couldn't. That's too logical. Put the animal scientists in one building and the economists in the other building and then don't let them talk. That's why we're where we are sometimes. Every school does it. Every school does it. We have had a disconnect between ag economics and animal science. We tend to think linear when we should be thinking lateral. That's reduced the application of innovative crossbreeding. And that's, I thought about these meetings, and there are some incredible thinkers here, and I really enjoyed yesterday. The knowledge of the scientists as they move us forward will revolutionize this industry. I have no doubt. But don't get the cart before the horse. The meetings, in some cases, could be a mile deep and an inch wide, when a commercial cattleman has to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And there is a disconnect there that BIF cannot afford to foster. I know Tom will challenge you more than I will, but I said that so he can really beat up on you later. Is that right? Now, where's this going? By the way, I've had caffeine since 4 o'clock this morning, if you're wondering. Okay, real quick, am I okay on time, Tom? Okay. Some of you know that we've played around with what I call a little bit of a field trial. You can call it a research project. That might be glorifying it a bit. And I'll tell you why. We want it to be a research project, but collecting data in real-world conditions isn't that simple. And it's called the Impact of Crossbreeding on Vertically Coordinated Beef Systems. A lot of folks involved. These happen to be pictures of Lacey livestock over on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada, God's country, as Dr. Talbot would call it. You can see there on the left how that's God's country, right? That's their winter feed conditions. And on the right is their summer feed conditions. So, like many of you, there's definitely two seasons. And I think the question was, we know what Clay Center, we know what Fort Robinson said about crossbreeding. We've seen all the research, but has it changed? Now don't we get rewarded for carcass merit in vertically coordinated beef systems? Okay, well, we'll look at it quickly. So what we did, a controlled, and that's probably a loose term, crossbreeding field trial under real-world conditions comparing Angus and Hereford bulls on an Angus-based cow herd. By the way, I know there are Angus and Hereford breeders in this room. This wasn't about the breed. And that's so hard for you to believe. I know that. And so you're one of the statistics of 1 or 10,000, and you're going to say, well, you use the wrong damn bulls, no matter what the results are. Just the way it works. This was about crossbreeding, not about breeds. Major traits that have the potential to impact overall profitability. Real quick, out of roughly a 2,000 cow herd in that program, we picked out, the first year it was about 400. In year two and three, we decided we needed more. Roughly 600 Angus-based cows, randomly made into 15 Angus or 15 Hereford bulls. We conducted the project for 3 years, and frankly, I believe, Mike Smith, we're going to harvest the last group of cattle Friday. So we were a week or two off being able to share any data that's final. We actually did DNA. You want me to stand still? I tend to pace. Okay. Sire verification through calf DNA samples, and the only animals included in the analysis were those that could be tracked to one specific sire rather than several sires. So our numbers got cut significantly. And I'm not going to, just so you see some of the country and some of the help. And this was in the summer part of the fall work in the eastern Sierras. And it's just beautiful country where these cattle are summered. And we were able to collect a lot of data. We had lots of participation in terms of electronic identification companies and scale systems to try and get this data in a field trial system. I can summarize the data in one slide, and I'm really sure that the early, like Dr. Cundiff, are going to be surprised. Economic impacts of crossbreeding and vertically coordinated beef marketing systems. We had a slight increase in weaning performance, a slight increase in average daily gain, an increase in feed efficiency, and these are with the, call them F1s, although put that in quotes, because they weren't straight Angus cows. A decrease in cost of gain, a decrease in quality grade, and an increase in net return. I'm so shocked. Spent a lot of money to get where we thought we would be, but it was important to do it again, and it's important to test it in a really harsh environment to see if it's real. And it was real. And you say, well, what's exactly the numbers and what model did you use? We'll publish that, and you can look at it, and you can argue with it. For your benefit, we've been using $10 choice select spread in the analysis. It's still a little less than that right now, folks. Okay? And the numbers varied, and I don't want to get too specific because it is preliminary, but by the time you added it together, you know, it's $40-$50 a head through the system, and that is an average, and if you want to quote that, I'll probably get in trouble when the final data comes out. So edit that in your report, please. Okay? But the interesting thing is, maternally, it was really hard to get the data. You know, you had to get these individual females that we knew were from one sire and then track them in a 2,000 cow outfit that is well managed, but that's a big place. The cattle cover lots of winter ground. The data we have some good information from, I believe Lucy's sitting in the room somewhere, where the heifers were AI'd in the feedlot. 7% increase in pregnancy rates of F1. F1 is in quotes because these weren't true F1s. Yearling heifers compared to straight breeds. That's dramatic. Over time, multiply that. The interesting thing, I believe, is, and I don't believe he's here, but Circle A, some of the work of Vern Pierce, they got almost the exact same number in a different location with lots of numbers. 7% increase. We're talking about longevity, live calves, replacement costs. Wow. You can tell me what numbers it adds up to, but it's a bunch by the time we're finished. Okay, I'm running out of time. These are called free Dave Daly opinions that have absolutely no basis in fact. They're kind of like Tom Field. Did we go to the same school with the same professor? I think as an industry we focus on sexy traits, not profit traits, for a long time. We focus on maximums rather than maximum return. When are we going to focus on maximum sustained profit per acre, per hectare, per unit? Not maximum dollars per head. If I don't know my input costs, I don't give a damn about outputs, period, end of story. It doesn't make a difference to anybody. And you guys have been to the sale barns where somebody has the biggest, heaviest wean calves, and they get a lot of coffee shop talk, and nobody knows what it costs to get them there. It's a moot point. And then there's another guy comes in with a baling wired together truck and some little lighter calves who has no debt, and really has got some things figured out, and he just doesn't talk to any of us. He just goes home and pockets the money. Not bad. Another opinion. Basic premise of seed stock production. All breeds can do all things. Just ask the breeders. Right? Somebody's going to tell me, well, you use the wrong Hereford bulls because you decrease quality grade. And somebody's going to tell me you use the wrong Angus bulls because the cattle didn't do as high as we thought they were going to. That's part of life. We have not capitalized on maternal and paternal lines. We spent far too much time trying to blur those lines rather than utilize the differences. Swine industry's done it much better than us. Even the sheep industry has done it a lot better than us, which is scary to say. They haven't done a lot of things well in this country, but they've done that better than we have. They know the difference between a ewe and a ram breed. We never figured it out in terms of the difference between maternal and paternal lines. This is another Dave Daly opinion. I need somebody to back me up. Randy Perry, please back me up if I need it. When EPDs became a marketing tool rather than a tool for genetic improvement, we lost our direction in genetic improvement. When we started chasing numbers rather than making the cattle better, I think it became a far less valuable tool. Not because it didn't work, but because we're just chasing numbers. Are we so busy trying to stay ahead of the EPD game that we don't thoroughly test cattle before they're widely used? What happened to a little bit of line breeding somewhere along the way? The old Jim Brink stuff? Are we narrowing? These are questions. I don't have answers. Tom and I, well, we're good at asking questions we can't solve. Are we narrowing the genetic diversity, the beef business, in the quest for the perfect product? Do we really want to be like Holsteins? I have a little bit of a connection to the dairy business. Cindy is founded and running an organic dairy at a university, which is an interesting challenge, shall we say. But I'll tell you, the dairy business isn't where I'd want to be. Cows that have tremendous outputs, that's wonderful. Holsteins that can't get bred, that will last for 3 lactations if they're lucky, that have tremendous functionality issues, and we're trying to propagate that? Please, we can use their genetic improvement practices only if we figure out what we want to improve. And if it's going to be maximums, forget it. You won't get the commercial guys doing it. Okay, gene markers. I have to add my little 2 cents here. They are remarkable science, potential tools. I had a very brief visit with at least one of the Australian scientists this morning, and they are doing phenomenal work. It will revolutionize the industry at some point in time. But don't burn the commercial business in the process. Because you, to a certain extent, a little bit of that's already happened, and you may not have another chance. Is the money really to benefit the commercial producer? And show me the money, Tom, from your slide. And this is just a question, but for a highly heritable trait that only account for a small amount of variability in the trait, aren't we doing already pretty good? You know, if you've got a high EPD accuracy for yearling weight and you breed a high one to a high one, you can get them bigger if you want. We can do the same with a lot of these traits. I'm more interested, and I know they're harder, and I think it was made pretty clear, we aren't providing the phenotypic data to these folks who can do the science to look for disease resistance, longevity, true profit makers that are lowly heritable. It's not their fault. They don't have the phenotypic data to do it. It's not that they don't want to do it, but they've got to go with the phenotypes they have, and presently we aren't providing them. And I think we still have a big Pandora's box in terms of genotypic environmental interactions, particularly if you saw that tough country Ron Terrell in Nevada on a greasewood flat. Do you think that those cows with a certain genotype are going to do the same as they do in Iowa in a different condition? And the answer is probably no. Okay, I'm almost out of time. We okay? Shut it down. 3 minutes. Cattle breeding. I had, I thought, 2 really great professors, and they were the best for me. Everybody finds their own. Dr. Taylor and Dr. Brinks. Let's make the complex simple. We seem bent on making the simple complex. Dwayne Martin, for those of you who went on the tour, is self-made, one of the largest cattlemen in the United States, has a pretty simple program. Because, at some point, he has to focus on the mile-wide stuff. Selection with inbreeds using EPDs, planned crossbreeding to capitalize on heterosis. So this is my report card. We have done a remarkable job increasing growth rate and mature size. We've gone from 135 million cattle to 100 million cattle or less in this country, producing the same amount of product. We've done it well. We focused on carcass merit. In some places, improvement. We've increased milk. You can read the list. We've made cattle phenotypically better, in quotes, because we've made them the same color. We've developed trait leader lists emphasizing maximums. We've selected for fertility with a feed truck. We've decreased emphasis on the ability of the cow to harvest low-quality forages. Do they take my plaque back now, or is that later? Okay. We have lots of measurements of horsepower. What about miles per gallon, warranty on the engine or powertrain, years of service, or is it buyer beware? I want some other majors. Final thought. At no time in the history of cattle breeding have we had the tools and the potential to more quickly and accurately make mistakes. Rest assured that we have the ability to screw them up quicker than we used to. That's a paraphrase of Steve Radakovich, by the way, who's here in spirit, if not in presence. And finally, Final thought. Product development in the beef industry. The beef industry is one of the few businesses that seem to develop products and then tell their customers what they need, rather than asking their customers what they need and building a product to do the job. Then they wonder about market penetration and accuse the commercial sector of not being progressive. What a model. I would suggest to BIF, who I greatly respect, that when you meet in Missouri next year, you spend one day or at least one session with all academics and purebred breeders listening to commercial progressive producers. Find out what they want. Find out what they want and then think about it rather than applying it to it. And I can't even tell my last story. Sorry about that. Can I? I can. I get to. Tom, it's nice to know you. Thank you. Makes up for taking my plaque back. The crossbreeding story, and I'll try and make it quick. How many of you coach or work with your kids in softball, soccer, football, something along the way, right? Are you competitive? Yeah. You got to win. And Robbie, don't listen to this story. My wife, Cindy, is very competitive. She denies it every time. But she was coaching youth soccer when Robbie was on the team, and she was one of the late additions. So you know what that means. They'd already picked the better players, the way life works. And you're thinking, well, we got one F, and this is going to be a long season. So she gets there to the practice, and there were some late ads. And the door opens, and out walks this very striking, very pretty African-American lady, and this big white guy, and two little twin boys. And my wife's eyes lit up. She understood hybrid vigor. We lost one game, and she's still mad about it. Thank you very much. It's been enjoyable. I'll be around to visit with you later.